Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. What you just heard was the title track from Avatar's Juno-winning album, Worldview, a group led by saxophonist and vocalist Sundar Viswanathan. He's proficient in a wide variety of jazz and world music genres, exploring that with high-profile groups such as Avatar, Sundar Quartet, and the Indus West Project. This interview happened last week, but in that time, Avatar's album Worldview won a Juno for Best Group Jazz Album of the Year. Before the interview, we'll check out another tune from Worldview, titled Chrysalis Emergence, a vocal arrangement of Waltz for Debbie from the Sundar Quartet album What a Dream I Had, and Far East End Blues from the Indus West Project album Hope and Infinity. Thank you.
populated by dolls and clowns and a prince and a big purple bear. Liv's my favorite girl, unaware of the worried frowns that we weary grown-ups all wear. In the sun, she dances to silent music, songs that are spun of gold, somewhere in her own little head. Someday, all too soon, she'll grow up and she'll leave her dolls and her prince and her silly old bear. When she goes, they will cry as they whisper goodbye. They will miss her, I know, but then so will I. Big purple bear lives my favorite girl, unaware of the worried frowns that we weary grown-ups all wear. Silent music, songs that are spun of gold, somewhere in her own little head. Someday, all too soon, she'll grow up and she'll leave her dolls and her prince and a silly old bear. When she goes, they will cry as they whisper goodbye. They will miss her, I know, but then so will. They will miss her, I know, but then so will I.
Joining us is Sundar Viswanathan, an award-winning and multi-Juno-nominated saxophonist slash vocalist. He earned his master's and PhD and takes influence from a wide variety of music genres, such as Indian and Brazilian classical music, the Beatles, Yes, jazz, and many more. His group Avatar got nominated for a Juno Award for Jazz Album of the Year for their CD, Worldview. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Nice to see you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, no problem. I guess the first question is, what inspired the creation of Worldview? What can you tell me about it?
Oh man, you know, this most of it was created during the pandemic. And of course we had a lot of time on our hands, right? And all kinds of crazy things are happening in the world. And, you know, combined with the politics, you know, North American politics, there was a lot of good information for inspiration to write music. So it was inspired by a lot of things, like just what was happening with, well, like I mentioned, the pandemic, the different situations that we find ourselves in, and then sort of the view of the world on our part of the world where the politics were, there was some stuff going on, you know, the people that don't, you know, infighting, and nobody agreeing on anything. So lack of unity, that was one thing.
Yeah, that's definitely a rich topic to draw from in terms of music.
Like
I noticed when I listened to, like, there were like a ton of like really cool like influences that you drew from, like some like Indian stuff and like some like kind of like modern stuff, and it was like really interesting. So I was wondering, like, what are your like influences, like where do you draw from?
Man, I listen to all kinds of music. I mean, like you mentioned, Indian music. I've listened to Indian classical music for most of my life. That's one. Lots of folk music, Brazilian music, particularly Antonio Carlos Jobim, Milton Nascimento, just Brazilian stuff. There's some really lyrical and beautiful melodic stuff there. And everything from African music to like, I mean, I was really, when I was in high school, I was really into art rock. I called it art rock back then. You know, I guess they call it prog rock now. But like Yes, Rush, Pink Floyd, that kind of stuff. And it's funny because I really like listening back to some of the music that I've been writing. I can hear that influence seeping in. Someone will say to me, yeah, I can hear that. I said, wow, I've never thought about that influence that really influenced me when I was younger. So there's that. That's kind of the roots of my music. And then of course, jazz, which is my foundation, you know, from late Coltrane, Dornette Coleman, to Jan Garbrecht, Keith Jarrett's a huge influence on me. You know, Snarky Puppy now, I've been checking stuff out, really, really great stuff. And, you know, there's so much great music. I mean, I there's certain music that I listen to a lot more than other stuff, but I've been trying to check out all kinds of stuff, even like hip hop, you know, Rick Ross, some Drake stuff, you know, some older stuff, some Guru, you know, Jazz Mataz, that kind of stuff. So there's a real wide influence. I feel like whatever it is, there's a lot of things. Sometimes if it impacts me, then it'll come in somewhere in the music and I don't even realize it, you know?
Yeah. Or like it just comes in like you don't expect it. And, oh, I heard this thing, or like, I heard this thing like a couple of weeks ago. Like, in fact, I literally listened to like Jazz Mataz again. And I was like, oh, this is really sick.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, it could be a couple of years ago. And it just like, it sort of sticks with you, right? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess going off of that, like you have like a bunch of like various groups that you've kind of built over the years. It's kind of like a mix of like Frank Zappa, Jazz Fusion, Kurt Elling, like a bit of like Maya Bush New Orchestra.
That's right.
And like there's like Avatar, there's like Indus West Project and Sundar Quartet. So I was wondering, like, how did you come to develop those groups? And like, what's your mission statement for each one of them?
I would say there's a few groups that I really spent more of my time on. There was one. See, when I lived in New York, there's a group called Ensemble Uniqua. And that is, it was kind of like, I was a lot younger then. And there was this youthful energy that we were just trying to like, we just wanted to play. And we wanted to play out there. And just, we had so much energy. And we were playing late night sets. I mean, some of these sets started at 2 a.m., you know, in New York. And it was kind of Afro jazz, a little bit of Indian stuff. And everybody in the band had their own personality. Some came with, you know, the drummer came with influence playing for like African dance, and then like a lot of you know, Latin music and stuff, and I came with my jazz and Indian influence, and then the trumpet player came some African. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that came around, and we all put our heads together and wrote music and put our little part in, and it, to me, that was the first start for me in creating like an eclectic sound. It was that was in the 90s the mid-90s when I played with that band. And that was in New York. And then from there, I'd say the four bands that really shaped my career was the first one. Another one one of my first bands called Sundar's Indus West Project, where I really started to like consciously incorporate Indian music into jazz and vice versa. And that band was a little more hard swinging in a way. Like my band now is more of a grooving a lot. So that one was in Toronto when I came to Toronto. And, you know, I much of my friends in town, some of the heavy hitters like Kevin Turcotte, Kelly Jefferson, Andrew Downing, you know, Anthony McKelly, David Braid, and then Reza Bassi from New York is a guitar player. I wrote a bunch of music and we got together and put an album out. And I wish I'd done more with that band, but that really helped me sort of find a direction for my sound in terms of my writing and the type of thing I like to write that I was really hearing. And then a band called Jaffa Road, which is not my band, but I'd say a co-leader in that band as I also co-write. And we've done a lot of touring all through Canada and also in Brazil and the United States. And that band was sort of another kind of mixture of jazz and some Indian music, but also Middle Eastern music and some Jewish music, Sephardic music, gypsy stuff. You know, sort of a real cross section, and again, it came with the influences of the people in the band, right? That band is run by a oud player named Aaron Lightstone, and that was a really big influence too, because we did so much playing together and a lot of touring, and it's really the tours that really makes things gel in a lot of ways. It's all that consistent playing night after night, and then finally, Avatar, which has been together for 10 years, so it's been a long road. A long trajectory in terms of hearing the sound of where my music was going, and you know, sort of finding the right people to present that music, you know, and make it sound like what it's supposed to. I don't hope that answers your question. It's kind of a long, long-winded answer.
Oh, definitely, yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I guess you kind of talked about like incorporating like Indian music and like all those different like aspects. So I was kind of wondering like, do you kind of, I guess depending on the tune, you kind of like pick and choose like different, like instruments, and like different, like odd meters. And is it kind of like a process that you think about, like as you're writing the tune, or is it more like a collaborative experience with the band?
No, I say my tunes because I write all the tunes. Write the tunes, I bring them in, and then we do some editing sometimes. But no, I mean, this is stuff like I hear the music. Usually I sing it into a tape recorder, or not a tape recorder, but my phone. And then I'll transcribe it and I'll have little themes or ideas. And then I'll go to the piano or I'll go on my horn and just work on those ideas. And, you know, sometimes the odd meters and stuff, it's not because I planned them. It's more because I felt like a phrase needed to stop here or need to be extended. If I extended it, it wasn't a symmetrical extension. It was an asymmetrical extension. So it became an odd meter. You know, so it's really like I sing a lot of these melodies. It really comes from a vocal place, singing it and trying to draw from inside. Like it sounds like kind of cliche, but it's inspiration that really brings these melodies out. Because when I think about an event or something that moves me or something that really makes me feel a certain way, I just basically dive into myself and try to get, you know, feel something. And then all these melodies start coming out. So it's sort of connecting with what's my inner, what I'm hearing internally, you know? So those odd meters, they come out, they're pretty sort of organic. They're not like manufactured.
Yeah. It's like talking. Like if someone transcribed talking, like you'd hear a bunch of weird rhythmic stuff.
Exactly. And in fact, that's some stuff, you know, if you listen to Hermeto Pascoal, some of the Brazilian guys, I mean, that's what they do, right? And you know, there's some modern guys that are doing that too now, but yeah, definitely. I mean, patterns, like life is not symmetrical, right? Life isn't like a series of, you don't walk in four beat steps and then walk another four steps. That's not how life works, right?
Yeah. Life is improvised.
Life is improvised. I mean, something can change and you have to like go with it, right? And that's kind of how I like my music to be. I like it to feel like it's got some organization, but at the same time, it feels a little bit loose. Like it feels like it goes to places that you wouldn't expect.
Definitely. Yeah. You can like kind of the band members should like fill that space or like pull back. So it's just that matter of trust too.
Yeah, you must be a musician.
Yeah.
Okay, I can tell questions you ask.
Yeah, very musician questions.
Great.
Yeah, I guess you've also studied in a variety of universities, and you received like your master's, a PhD, bachelor's, and diploma, like in jazz, classical, world performance, and composition. So how have all those like difficult, like different musical avenues contributed to your perception and like ideas around music?
Well, every place I went to had its own thing, if you want to say, put it that way. My first degree was an undergrad degree in classical saxophone. And to be honest with you, I didn't even know what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a film composer to start with. I still love film music. So that's part of, that's, you know, a cinematic approach to music is, I like that and compositionally. But to my undergrad, I went to Laurier. In Waterloo, and I did I started as a composition major, and I was a composition major, but I ended up playing so much that I just realized how much I loved to play, and that's where I really found out that I loved to play. So the writing started there, and that's where I sort of got some techniques and started listening to things I'd never heard before. So that sort of developed my appreciation for classical music, because there was no jazz when I went there, pretty well no jazz, and I studied classical. And then my sax teacher told me, you know, you got to study some jazz now, because you've done all these classical concertos and you played the sonatas and all this other music. You've got to go and learn how to play jazz because you play saxophone, right? So I went to Humber, and then I got, you know, I started practicing like crazy and studying the jazz repertoire and, you know, learning that music. And then it was jazz from there. But Humber gave me some foundational jazz stuff. And then I went to New England Conservatory in Boston for my master's, where, you know, that school has got a lot of sort of free music and a lot of really sort of creative, I say creative music, meaning like not sort of structured, open music. And that really helped me with that kind of stuff. And also a lot of world music there too, got a lot of my world music foundations. And then NYU was kind of putting that all together and doing what I love to do for my doctorate, right? So there was all the influences also came from the cities that they were in. Cause you know, you got Waterloo, which is not a jazz city, but it's classical. And I got my classical stuff together. And then, Boston is a real eclectic mix of stuff. A lot of really cutting edge stuff in Boston. And then New York, of course, is, you know, everything, right? So it was really great to have all these different worlds of information coming to me.
Yeah. You can just like keep piling up those influences and like just use them like when you're just doing stuff.
Yeah.
And also, I guess all the people you've played with as well, like you've played with a large amount of people as well.
Yeah. There's some people, I'm kind of old. So, you know, I think back to the early days. I mean, I was just really lucky to be in the right place at the right time. I mean, being able to play with people like Sun Ra and Clark Terry, I played with Muhal Richard Abrams, Kenny Wheeler, and then of course the greats are in Toronto, you know, Pat LaBarbera and Don Thompson and people like that. And Terry Clark, and then other people, Joe Lovano, we played together in concert, and Kenny Werner. There's been a lot of really great people that have gone through my life. And I think part of it's, you know, I was just lucky to be at the right place at the right time and, you know, made some of the right choices and, you know, maybe practice when I should have practiced. I missed opportunities too, because I didn't practice. So, you know, there's that too, but there's been so many people and had so many mentors, whether they thought of themselves as mentors or not, just hanging out with these people, talking to them and learning from them. And of course, playing with some of them was an incredible experience.
Yeah. This is a very nerdy piano player question, but I saw that you had studied with Barry Harris. So I was wondering what was that like?
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. How could I forget Barry? Barry was great. This was, let's say, over 20 years ago, 25 years ago, probably, where he was giving a lot of workshops in Toronto. And I went to a handful of them, several of them. And it was great. I mean, he's information, his brain moves so quickly. I was fried after these sessions. Like my brain was completely fried. And I got to go back. I mean, I still work on that stuff to the day. You know, there's stuff that I work on that I learned from Barry. So I should have mentioned him right at the top. Like, he was a huge influence. And, I went to maybe three or four weekend sessions with him. But even that, massively influential, because the information that you get there, that lasts you a lifetime, you know. And I should mention all too, Charlie Bonakis. You might not even know who he is.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, he's... a legend. He died like a handful of years ago, but he was out in like Framingham, Boston, near Boston, like I said, Summerhill. I forget where it was near Boston. Anyways, when I was going to school in Boston, I had to wait on a waiting list for 2 years to study with him. And finally got to study with him. And he's one of these guys is like, he gave up his performing life to just teach. He was a great piano player and arranger. He gave up his life. He created all these methodologies, all these approaches and practices, and he really refined them. And he really thought through this stuff out. And, you know, he had students like Mike Stern. Mm. I think Michael Brecker, I think, studied with a lot of like big name people studied with him. And genius, like a real genius, and such a nice, lovable guy. So I studied with him, and I've got still like a pile of papers that I still don't know what to do with. You know, I still haven't gone through them. And George Garzon, the same thing. I studied with George Garzon in Boston for probably 3 years, and his stuff is, you know, I'll be honest, I wasn't ready for it when back in the day. You know, I was trying to learn some, you know, how to play my scales back in those days, right? But so these teachers, they leave you with so much stuff and information, and then even if there's only a few things that you use or what they give you, that's like enough, you know, to really get you to another place in your music.
Oh yeah, I can relate to that. I'm like almost finished my degree, and like there's just so much stuff that I've learned over the years. Like I just need to go through all of them.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
It's so much.
It's about refining and finding out what of that is you. Like what makes you, you know, what ticks. What do you relate to? What stuff do you resonate with? Because you might not resonate with all that stuff, right?
Mm, yeah,
that's what I'm finding is like all the stuff that I have. I don't have another 2 lifetimes to absorb all that stuff, you know, which I'm pretty sure it would require. But there is some of that stuff that I do want to get together. So, you know, you can only do so much, you know, so much energy, right?
Yeah. Maybe they'll build a time machine in the future or something and
come back.
Just get through all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess to pivot to like another thing, I saw that Avatar was the grand prize winner for the John Lennon songwriting competition. So like what tunes did you write for that?
That was Jaffa Road.
Oh, Jaffa Road. Oh
yeah. Yeah. Jaffa Road. That was the other band. One of the other bands I played in. We won an award. One of the awards. I can't remember which one it was, but yeah, the song John Lennon competition. I don't remember which tune it was for though, but yeah, that was, Jaffa Road was also nominated twice for Juno, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. That was cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, where does the name come from, Jaffa Road?
So Jaffa Road is a road in Israel, in Jerusalem, I think, pretty well Jerusalem, where sort of the Arab community and the Israeli community mix and they meet. And, you know, there's no, you know, fighting there, I hope, I don't think. But that's sort of the road. If it's a place where the two cultures can meet. And so this was kind of a fitting title for the kind of music that we're playing, because it's just Arab music and there's Jewish music and Indian music and jazz and stuff. So it's a mixture.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like I never knew about that. So that's pretty cool. Yeah.
It's our nod to, you know, our hope towards some kind of peace, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of things going on in the world right now.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I guess just came to me, but what do you think like a musician's role is like for like big world events, like in terms of like, can a musician adequately kind of convey like a sense of like an event, like through music without it feeling like hackneyed?
It's a very good question. I think it's important that we do that. I mean, I feel like there's kind of, I don't know, I could get in trouble for this, but there's kind of 2 different kinds of music. There's music that's music for ego's sake and for money's sake, maybe. And then there's music for a change.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think all music has the capacity to make change. I think some music is just there because people just want to be, you know, want to be important or, you know, win awards or make a lot of money or something, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's important though, as artists, let's put it that way, to try to make some kind of statement in your music. And I think it can be done. I think music is one of the best ways to do it, because music, you know, I think it's good to have a perspective on what the music means to the artist, so that someone is listening. I'm sorry, how do I keep getting this phone call? I turned it off. Sorry. I think it's really good or important that the artist is relaying what his intention is for the music. And sometimes it means talking about the music and saying where this music came from and what it means to him. And then maybe others will hear that, because, I mean, yeah, you can play something that's really beautiful. Like, you know, you'll hear Beethoven's Ninth or something, and immediately it sounds beautiful. And it makes you feel a certain way. But then if you read the story behind Beethoven's Ninth, then it really sets a context. And it really gets you to understand, you know, what that artist was going through and what his intentions were for that. And just how, you know, then it finds a different kind of level of meaning, I think. So to come back to a question more accurately, I think we have to create the context for the meaning in the music and then relay it to the listener. And I think we can be successful if our intentions are good. I mean, if you are authentic and honest about the music and you really come from a place that it's a real place, you know, place of authenticity, then it's not going to be hackneyed. It's not going to be manufactured. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I've been asking the question, like, yeah, I've been playing music for a long time. I know I have touched a lot of people, and people have come up to me and said I was moving. And back in the day, we didn't necessarily talk about what the music meant to us, but now I'm doing that a lot more because I want people to know that this is what I was thinking about when I, for instance, my tune, Little Kurdy from the album Worldview for Alan Kurdy. And that was written for the little boy that washed up on the beach a handful of years ago on the Turkish shore. Who was a refugee from Syria, and he was being basically trafficked, you know, refugee trafficked, and the boat capsized. They had too many people on the boat, and this little boy, 3-year-old boy, washed up on the shore. So, you know, having a child about the same age at that time, it's a pretty powerful thing, right? Pretty moving thing, and something like that should not go unnoticed and unrecognized, and there has to be some change that comes from that. At least a way of thinking. The more you recognize these things, the more you can change the world. And it could be the things like the war. It could be the plights of refugees around the world and people who are suffering in you know, children who are suffering in whether they're refugees or whether they come from a broken family or whatever it might be. I think it's really important for artists, you know, to not all artists, but for some artists to have the intentions to write about these things and to project their feelings around it, because I think music can get to a deeper place than words sometimes. Sounds can get to a deeper place. You know, it comes from everything, right? From vibration. So basically everything is sound. So I think sound is a very powerful vehicle to get messages. And then when you add the word a little bit, meaning not lyrics necessarily, but talk about what this is about. And then, you know, someone hears it in context and it becomes a very, you know, it can be a change for them. It can make that kind of change or flip something that makes them see that event in the way that maybe an artist who has a different viewpoint, maybe more sensitive, quote unquote, or has a different perspective to that, that where maybe the listener can see that perspective, and then maybe it will change them and cause some action perhaps.
Definitely. Yeah, that was a great answer. Yeah. And already I can think of like tunes that people are still talking about that, like you said, like they are going to like a specific place, they're talking about like a specific event, and like they still resonate with people, like John Coltrane's Alabama, for example.
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, if you hadn't said what that was about, it would still be beautiful. It would still be moving, but really it wouldn't really have, you know, in the Martin Luther King, you know, coming from Martin Luther King's speech and all that, you know, it's powerful. I mean, think about it. It's also this, right? You're combining all different sort of inputs, sound, you know, it's all sound, but I mean, music, words, which is the, you know, coming from the speech, poetry or political thought, you know, all those different things, they come together and they create this much more powerful sort of, you know, message, this vehicle for this message, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess, are there any, I guess future gigs or any future projects coming up?
Yeah. We are playing at the Toronto Jazz Festival, Avatar, on July 3rd. I'm going to double check that. I'm pretty sure it's July 3rd. July 3rd in Yorkville. Those of you guys who are listening from Toronto, if you're listening from Toronto. July 4th. Uh-huh. July 4th, 4 p.m. Oh, nope. Sorry. July 3rd at 6:45 p.m. Sunday, July 3rd. The Toronto Jazz Festival. We're playing at Silence in Guelph on the June 18th, I think it is. But people who are in Guelph can look that up. Yeah, June 11th. Yeah. So a couple of things. I'm trying to think of anything else. Junos are coming up this weekend, so we're excited about that. And there'll be some more stuff. I hope to get some tours. Hope to come back out west. We were out west a few years ago. We had some really nice concerts, but we want to come back out there. So
nice. Yeah. Thanks again for the interview and congrats on the Juno, good luck.
Nomination. Yeah. Thank you so much. Can I direct people to my website? Would that be okay?
Sure. That's fine.
Yeah. It's www.sundarmusic.com. SUNDARmusic.com.
Cool.
Yeah.
Are there any tracks from the album that you'd like to play it with?
Do you want to play Little Curdy?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they work great.
Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks to Sundar Viswanathan for being here on the show. Before the interview, you heard the tracks Worldview and Chrysalis, Emergence from Worldview, Waltz for Debbie from What a Dream I Had, and Far East End Blues from Hope and Infinity. We'll end it off with the track Little Curdy from Worldview, which was written for Alan Curdy, the 2-year-old boy who ended up drowning during the Syrian refugee crisis 5 years ago. This is Canadiana Suite, signing off.